introduction, but I think we're ready to go.
Dave does not need any more introductions. Go right ahead, Dave.
Okay. Welcome, everyone. It's nice to be together with everyone, at least in this format. I wanted to begin with checking in on a topic that came up last time, and I didn't really go into it sufficiently, so I'll start with that. It's the distinction that we made between a trigger that can help us and a trigger that kind of upsets us. And I'll use examples. Let's say you are using a certain product and you find out that the company that makes this product is doing what really harms the environment. And so you're triggered by this sense of injustice. You're angry that this company that you thought was really okay turns out to be acting not in the best interests of the planet. This leads you to take some type of action. For instance, you boycott the company by not buying the product anymore. You send a letter to your senator asking that some type of bill be passed that could make a difference. You find out online or from social media that there are other people who are also upset by what this company is doing, and you join them. Maybe you're even going to become part of protest, a demonstration. What's happened is you've been triggered, but instead of the trigger causing harm to you or anyone else, the trigger has led to action for justice. So that would be an example of a positive trigger. And it's wonderful that we can get triggered and become indignant about injustice and take action. Now, the other kind of trigger, which is the one we're mainly talking about, that would be a negative trigger. Here's an example. Someone cuts you off in traffic and you lose your temper, fly into a road rage, and you are swearing at the other driver, you are making obscene gestures, you are driving erratically to try to get around this other driver, or you are getting so close to this driver that you're getting him or her upset also. Now what's happened is you've been triggered into a rage. This rage, which is extreme anger that causes harm, overlooks the original feeling that you had, which was fear. Because when someone cuts you off, it's just normal to feel fear that you might be in danger. You disregarded the fear, went straight to the anger. The anger became rage. And that would be an example of a trigger that led to some kind of harm. And the third alternative is knowing that people will cut you off in traffic occasionally, or that something will happen that annoys you. You have decided on a spiritual practice. You've decided that when someone cuts you off, instead of going into all that I just described, you are going to take your foot off the accelerator so that you slow down and let that other driver keep going, create a distance between you and that dangerous driver. And instead of swearing at him or her, you are doing some kind of affirmation like, may you arrive safely, may you not cause harm to yourself or others. May you find the enlightened way. Anything like that. So now what's happened is you're using your trigger mechanism to activate a spiritual practice. So that would be a trigger that helps you find yourself spiritually. So instead of reacting from ego, which goes to road rage, you are responding with first safety by taking your foot off the accelerator, and secondly, something that shows a caring connection instead of an angry division between you and someone else. So I just wanted to clarify that set of distinctions so that we all understand it's that triggers can help us. They're not just stimuli that push us out of control. Are there any questions about what I just said before I go on?
If you have one, you can type into the chat.
Or raise your hand.
Or raise your hand virtually, or if I can try to catch you raising your hand in your picture, I could unmute you that way.
Okay, well, if you do have a question, just raise your hand anytime. And this time we were reading chapters 2, 3, and 4. Chapter 2 is about trauma. And we did talk somewhat about this last time. But I just want to read one paragraph on page 37. This is at the beginning of the chapter. And I start with this little statement. We are not turtles. We are turtles, not birds. Excuse me. We carry our childhood home with us all through life, the way a turtle carries its home. And we can't fly away from it the way a bird flies away from its nest. So that's just the nature of being human. So that would mean that what happened to us, either in early life or in recent relationships, could inflict some wounds that don't fully go away. Even when we work on them, they still remain as scars, and they could get in the way of having healthy relationships. And I'll be doing a whole separate chapter on triggers in relationships. But for now, I'm on 37. A trigger takes us by storm when it reinstates painful experiences from early life. Our more hard-hitting trigger points may have been implanted by some original abuse or trauma. And such, now it's experienced as post-traumatic stress, and such post-traumatic stress is difficult to unsee because the trigger keeps reopening the wound, it keeps re-stimulating the original pain. And the good news is that our pain is coming from a helpful scalpel, something that's meant for our healing. It's a nudge into our work. So once you notice, for instance, that you're really triggered when people criticize you, and you make the connection, oh, my father criticized me constantly, or my mother criticized me, or in a past relationship, I was really burdened by criticism. The new experience of criticism in the present is hooked up to the past, and so the personal work that you do is on the original experience of being criticized, which you may never have fully addressed, processed, and resolved. So this is another example of how triggers are the trailhead that start you off hiking into that back country of your own life where there are so many thorn bushes that are still scratching you. And we want to kind of make peace with that inner environment, make it safer. Triggers always come from a place that was originally unsafe and make us feel unsafe in the present. So let's just keep in mind as we go along that that's all part of our picture of triggers. And I'll be going back to this as we continue, because I want to connect this to the other two origins of triggers, which is our shadow side or our ego. I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But first, I want to go to the handy tools section. So this is where I talk about how to deal with triggers. What helps so that they don't mess us up as much as they have in the past? And now I'm on page 53. And if you see there, starting on 53, I go on for 3 or 4 pages, and I have all these bullets that show you actual exercises that you can use so that triggers don't disturb you as much. And the first one is the one that I found so helpful. I'm on the bottom of 53. Naming. If you can name your trigger, what bothers you the most. For instance, I'm triggered when I'm criticized. So that's one of my trigger points. Naming is a primary way of dealing with a trigger. Making a list of your familiar repeated triggers leads you to be on the lookout for them and have a plan to deal with them once they become activated. This is one of my triggers, so let me be careful not to overreact. Instead, I want to handle it this way, as in the example of road rage. We are catching the trigger red-handed and are ready to deal with it without being devastated by it. Now we can distinguish between what just happened factually and what impacts us personally. We make a conscious response rather than act on a reflex. This escape from compulsion is our gateway to freedom. So I really want to make clear that a trigger has something to do with compulsion because we feel forced to respond a certain way. We don't see other options open to us. We just have to lose our temper, or we have to get scared and panicked or suddenly cry out of sadness. To find out Rumpelstiltskin's name is to be free of his threats. So I'm suggesting keeping a journal that lists your triggers and your reactions, and using what you will find in here, in our book, Triggers, in this journal, you can make note of the various ways to handle triggers. But the very first one, and this is the one that I found, like, in my own experience, 70% less reactivity in me once I realized the connection between the trigger and the past. So it's not just naming, it's also trying to get to what the origin of it was. So let's use an example of the inner critic. Now I'm on page 55. We're triggered by the inner critic, the voice that tells us we're not what we're supposed to be. And we could just reply by saying, no, that's not true. I don't recommend that. That reaction will tie us into a web of back and forth with a voice trained much better than we on how to put us down. So my suggestion, when the inner critic speaks up, instead, we use the inner critic's commentary about us as a call, a bell that reminds us to perform our spiritual practice of loving kindness toward ourselves. For instance, when the voice says, you're going to fail as you always have, we neither argue nor agree. We don't say, no, I'm not going to fail. We don't say, yes, I will fail. We go straight to our affirmation. I trust myself to do the best I can and to handle whatever may happen. Now what you're doing is you're using the voice of the inner critic to help you raise your self-esteem and your sense of your own empowerment. So the voice of the inner critic becomes what in Buddhism is called a skillful means to help you evolve. And you're not thrown for a loop. You have a way of responding. But it can't be argumentative. And also it can't be a complete denial. Now there's one more point I wanted to make here. And now I'm on 57. Family members are experts on triggering us. They know every one of our buttons and exactly how and when to push them. We're not putting anybody down, we're just noticing. They keep their fingers on the nuclear reactors, and it's no wonder that we're affected so strongly when we are with them, such as family dinners. Being on the lookout, fending off, while remaining loving at all times, is our practice. So when we respond to the trigger of the inner critic, we do so with loving kindness toward ourselves. When we're with family members, we are doing our loving kindness practice for them and ourselves. We remain present, we stay with them, but only until the firing begins. Firing of the guns that are aimed at us. And then we vacate the premises. That's how we protect our boundaries and our sensitive little hearts. We are, in effect, raising our hand with a signal of no or stop, the way a traffic cop does. His purpose and ours are the same. Not judgment or scolding, but safety for all. So you have to ask yourself, am I willing to do that? Or do I just want to kind of play nice? Am I ready to show that you just can't keep doing things like this to me? And this would be family or relationship. Any questions on this part so far?
Yeah, Dave. Yarko has one for you, so I'm going to find
him. Okay, hi, Yarko.
Unmute him really quickly.
Yeah.
There you go, Yarko. You should be unmuted.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yep.
Yes.
Hi, Dave. So I have a question. Since I was in reading these chapters, going through, not surprisingly, not only reflecting on my own sort of normal human triggers, but on the waves of triggers of throughout my family. You know, my parents were in the middle of Poland just before the beginnings of World War II, and my grandfather was at, you know, thrown into Auschwitz, and my parents were manipulative, which is why I did a lot of therapy, and I kept reading understandings into them. So here's my question, and it's about my adopted child, and I think I know the answer, but I want to hear it out loud. You said a while ago that getting to the source, the origin of your triggers, helps us unpack them. So here's the example. My daughter was burned age 4 over 70% of her body, in hospital for a year. Her mother died 2 months after she got out of being in the hospital for a year. And then suddenly she was orphaned. She was in Ukraine. And then a month after she was orphaned, the Soviet Union fell apart and there was chaos, right? When she was 6, she remembered vividly being flown in a helicopter, the black skin on her body falling off, thinking she was going to die, details of her mother's funeral, how she wasn't allowed to attend. By the time she was 12, she had literally not dulled memories, but no memories of it. I tried a couple of times when she was a teen to recount her stories, and she looked at me like I was speaking to a stranger. She's in her mid-30s now, and I think helping her walk back to the origin of those triggers probably may not be healthy. So an extreme trauma like that, where our brain or our mental stuff protects us from those memories, talk about that. How do people with those kind of triggers, what's the appropriate way to be around them or to be them? That's my question. That's a big question too. So
yeah, it is. Well, first of all, it would be important for anyone who's had the kind of experience you're describing to go to a therapist who's trained in trauma work. That is a specialty. Secondly, it's a matter of timing. It could take us close to a lifetime even to be willing to look at what happened to us. And sometimes what happened was so painful and wounding that we're better off not looking at it. But the most important thing is that family members can't help you get to the work that you need to do. They can only be supportive of your getting the help that you need. So we have to be careful about that, like with our adult children or with any family member. We're just too close to the scene to give the kind of help that's required. But we do want to make it clear that we're going to support them in finding that help. So that's how I would look at it. And I know you're a caring person, Yarko, and you want to see your daughter get the kind of healing that is necessary. And you don't want to put that burden on yourself. Did you have more to say about it, Yarko? Is Yarko unmuted?
I think he muted himself.
Oh, okay. Here you are. Yeah, go ahead, Yarko. I think
you're back.
Am I back now?
Yeah.
You're back.
Okay, so I have then one last follow-up question. This makes sense. Being by them instead of sort of saving them makes a lot of sense. So here's the final follow-up question. I found journaling of my mother's, who was born in her displaced persons camp behind barbed wire after she passed, that she never spoke about her experiences, her first 4 years of life behind barbed wire and guards, how it seemed normal until it wasn't. So my question is, do you think it would be helpful for me to journal and document what I remember of my daughter's stories so that if she would like them, she has them after I'm long gone? Or do you think it'd be better to just leave that alone?
Matter of personal choice.
Yeah.
But you want to be careful because people who are highly sensitive might get re-traumatized when they read that kind of a journal.
Exactly, yeah.
So I would be careful about that.
Okay, thank you.
Good. I think somebody else had a question?
Yeah, we've got another question. I can't see the first name, but Reichert, I think, is the last name there.
Judy.
Judy, feel free to speak up.
Hi, Judy.
You just muted yourself, Judy. There you go. You're good to go now.
Go ahead.
Are you talking to Reichert?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. It's Charlene. Sorry.
Hey, Charlene.
It's not Judy. So
that's where we're mixed up.
I have to go
back. I see. It's Judy Goodrich. Okay. Go ahead.
I have to go back and find my question.
All right.
We're all involved in Yarko's. okay. we have a family member that is easily triggered because of childhood trauma. She married in. And then now places all that on us. We are the stand-ins for her. So she attacks us and our son. Her response when we say, no, this is my boundary, is to say we are passive aggressive. So how do you do that rightly? I understand the compassion thing, but she doesn't want to hear the compassion thing. She wants to continually attack. So we kind of are defenseless, and then we pull back even more and leave her traumatized again because we have kind of abandoned her because she's so abusive to the people around her now.
Has anyone ever been able to get it across that we welcome your sharing about your own pain, but as soon as it crosses the line and becomes abusive toward any of us, then we can no longer listen to you? That is the kind of thing you would have to say.
Yeah, and we've done that and basically lost the relationship. So now for me, it's a grieving because we lost her, but it's also very difficult for my son who was, you know, that was his primary relationship.
Yeah, it is sad the way this all plays out, isn't it? And there's not much you can do about it except what you have done. And you're right, it leads you to a grieving because it creates a big division in the family itself. So all we can do is welcome anything that is said that is clear and non-harming, and when it becomes harming, then we have to hold up our hand like the traffic cop and say it's impossible to hear you now because, you know, it's become abusive in itself, is what you're basically feeling. And sometimes the only thing you can do is leave the premises.
Yeah.
Dave, we've got about six other questions in here if we'd like to keep going or
okay.
Spend more time here if we need.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, I see Gloria Regan has a hand up, so I'm just going to unmute you.
Oh, no. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to put my hand up.
Okay. Well, I'll put it down and we'll go to the next one.
Hi, Dave.
Hi.
How about Mary Beth?
Yeah. Hi, Dave. First, thank you for a very rich and important and timely book. It will deserve a second read. I'm very grateful. My question is about the family dinners and how do we have an awareness about being the triggerer. How do we deal with being aware when we have triggered someone and to be tuned into it? Because especially with adult children, sometimes it's hard to navigate.
Do you have an example?
Well, sometimes I will say something perhaps, okay, here's an example. Mom, you've already said that. And I may have repeated myself.
We've all heard that one.
Yeah. But then it goes on to the next sort of thing. It kind of escalates a little. And then I get a little hurt and embarrassed. And then there's an apology. And then there's not really wanting to apologize because really I'm driving them crazy. So there's kind of an escalation. But more to the point, like if I say something about a child or I say something about a bar of soap. I mean, it always feels innocuous to me, but sometimes it seems like there's a trigger by the reaction and I don't know where to go. How do you speak to like, oh, I think I've triggered you? Do you say it out loud or do you just...
You say it very directly.
Yeah.
I guess I said something that triggered you. Can you tell me what's happening? You have to remember that they're responding to the you that they've known all these years. They're not responding to what you just said. So that's why it's hard to put it together in your own mind. Like, what did I say that was so wrong? But actually, they're hearing more than what you just said. It's familiar to them in a way that is still unresolved. Secondly, sometimes we might say something that has the feeling of judgment in it, and other people will certainly be triggered by that. So we're always going to be on the lookout for that. At the same time, you have free speech. You can say what you want to say, as long as you're willing to deal with the consequences. Hippocrates, Hippocratic Oath, ancient Greek physician, he was the first to say, mental health problems are not caused by the gods. They are illnesses just like physical illnesses. That was new. And he started a sanitarium, and he took in people who were severely depressed or people who, what we now call psychotic or schizophrenic and so forth. He set up a program for them and treated them as patients who needed help. But in order to be in this sanitarium, you had to follow his little list of rules. Rule number one for you to find healing. Rule number one. No family visits. So even in ancient times, it was clear that family members can activate all kinds of reactions that aren't good for your health. We love them, but we also notice that. Anyway, I thought you'd get a kick out of that. It's kind of humorous. Somebody else had a question?
Yeah, we got four more.
Okay, go ahead.
Catherine Dean, I just unmuted you. If you want to unmute yourself, you feel free to speak.
Okay. It's Hi. Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, Dave. I'm going back to page 57 that you were reading from.
Yes.
And you the wording you used was vacating the premises.
Yeah.
Are you meaning that literally? Or
yes, I am.
You are.
Yeah. And you're going to use my 7-word solution. Oh my God, look at the time. And off you go.
Well,
you will be back, but they start to get it that if you want Michael to remain in the room, you can no longer do that. Gradually they get it.
Okay. Just a quick comment. In my experience, it's not always possible to physically leave. And a little technique I learned of some time ago when that I wish I were better at using is when someone triggers you, is to say, ouch.
Well, we have that, too.
Yes.
We have
that. I have that in the book as one of the ways to respond. So it's ouch and open a dialogue. Okay, somebody else had a question?
All right, Jeannie, I believe is the name. Mm-hmm. You're unmuted, you're welcome to go.
Hi, Jeannie.
Yeah, I had a question. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you froze for a second.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
You're muted again.
Oh, I think you muted yourself again, yeah. Just hit unmute and you should be able to go ahead.
All righty. I just had a quick question of what you started to say, that not to react with judgment or scolding, but to, and then I didn't catch what the next.
But safety for all.
With what?
Safety for all.
Oh, great.
That's what the traffic cop is interested in doing. He wants safety for all, not
okay.
You're wrong for doing that.
All right. Well, I have a little bit similar situation with an in-law to our first respondent there. So this sister-in-law is the issue. Is that my brother is very controlled by her. So without her, without his support for the rest of the family, he's afraid of her. So he always kind of sides with her and he's very intimidated by her. So we're kind of left standing holding she's extremely super hypersensitive about anything you say to her, but has a complete disregard for what she says about us, and is really very toxic and very tactful. So I don't live in the same state as she does, and can remove myself, except now we have a family situation where my mother is, you know, very sick and on hospice. So we do have to deal with my brother, but this is the thing. She's waiting for a moment. She looks for moments to cut my brother off from family dynamics and decisions we need to make, knowing that we have to have the dialogue right now to make these family decisions with my mom on hospice. This is like a good drama for a TV show. So anyway, I know what you're going to, I have an idea of what you might, it's really up to my brother to open that door maybe.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there's not much you can do in a situation like that. I mean, you can talk to him privately, you know, sister to brother. And, do you get scared by her? Or, you know, you have to kind of inquire into it. But there's probably very little you can do to change it.
Yeah, but what do you do when you're in a situation where you really need, right now, we really need the cohesiveness, you know?
You'd have to say that. You'd have to ask for that. But you can't make it happen, unfortunately.
Okay.
That's why these family issues are so difficult for all of us.
Yeah, and I can't close the door or walk away. I mean, this is like kind of a crucial time. So.
You can't close the door and you can't even open it.
This will be a good exercise.
And you can't, you know, totally leave because you've got a family issue.
Thank you.
Well, good luck with it.
Thank you so much.
I think a lot of us can relate to it. Somebody else had a...
Yeah, Yoli. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but...
Okay, hi, Yolanda.
Yeah, I'm just trying to find you here so I can unmute you quickly. There you are. Okay, I'm going to unmute. There you go.
Okay, so I find myself not easily triggered. So my question would be, does it mean I am abnormal? The other thing that as I posted here is that somebody who is somebody I know very well said, oh, don't sing. That is in church. In church, when they sing the Our Father, I join them singing the Our Father. And then when they sing like, in they say prayers, they sing Nada de Turbe, which is one of my favorite songs, I would sing also. And then she told me, oh, don't sing because you're out of tune. And I don't really have very high regard for her. And I also was once a president of the Lyceum Glee Club. So in my mind, I was in the Glee Club and nobody ever told me that I was out of tune. Does it mean that they elected me because of the funding that I'll be able to generate to the Glee Club? Or does it mean I really know how to sing? So I went to my youngest son, who is an engineer, but also a musician. And he said, no, Mom, you're really not out of tune. It's just that you tend to go from alto to bajo, and somebody who is not familiar with those changes could think that you are getting out of tune. But my question then is that, so the first one is, if I don't get triggered, does it mean I'm abnormal or that, and you use the word...
sounds like you're lucky.
And you use the word sensitive little heart. I do believe I have a sensitive heart, but I can't always, you know, give importance to somebody's words, especially if I don't have regard that person. So what do you say about that?
I guess the alternative to being triggered would be you just take things as matter of fact and you're not pushed to react. You just notice it. And the way you handled it was very well. You checked it out with somebody who really knows about music, and he says, no, you're not out of tune. So next time you will sit next to somebody different who will be okay with your singing, I guess. But once again, we can't make people see the light or see what we're really up to if they're not open to it. If they've already passed judgment, it's really a fool's errand to try to convince them otherwise. Often in therapy, I notice, let's say it's a wife talking about a husband or vice versa, I can tell that he or she is trying to convince the other person about something. And as soon as you start doing that, it triggers the other person who gets what you're up to and feels manipulated. So the alternative is dialogue. Let's just talk about this rather than here's what I think you should do. Okay, there was one more question.
Yeah, Joan Kershaw. I'm going to unmute right now. Oops. Are you there, Joan?
I am. Hi.
Hi, Joan.
Hi, Dave. Thanks so much. It's a great chapter and great chapters. When you talked about the family members or experts are triggering us, sometimes that family member is not even aware that they're triggering us, and so I'm the one with the trigger. And so it's like I can't really walk away from it because, you know, they wouldn't even understand. And so it's sort of continual, you know, it's like all the time. And so sometimes I just want to avoid the relationship and, you know, I don't know, what did I say? Do I tell them what's going on? Especially not when I'm in the triggered state, because then that just is like blaming. I don't want to react in their face, but I can't ever seem to reconcile why, again, here it is again, here it is again, you know, in the moment. You know, I can't really deal with it in the moment. I can't walk away from it. You know, how do I like journal it and process it and bring it to her? I don't even think she would understand. I think it's all me.
So the alternative to bringing it to her would be to make it your own, the topic for yourself to look at.
Yeah.
That probably makes sense.
Yeah. And then just watch every time I get triggered and don't walk away from it, right? Because then yeah. That's avoiding the stimulus.
But, you know, you brought up an important point, which somebody else brought up too, and that is when we're the ones triggering, it really is good to check in with other people and say, this way I have of putting things, or what I just said, or the way I'm acting, does it bother you? You don't have to use the word trigger, but, or you could say, am I triggering you? Am I pushing your buttons? Anything like that shows a willingness to make a change. And it may not be possible to make such a change, but when you show that you really want to work on things so that we can have better communication, that does make a big difference.
Yeah. Thanks.
And I was just thinking that another feature of family issues is that they are the hardest to work out. I have noticed that. It's even harder than working out, you know, between two partners. Issues that come up.
Yeah.
Because you have so much history together. And you have so many memories, projections, expectations that were never met, needs that you've never expressed. there still might be competition between you and your brothers and sisters, even though now we're all too old for that now. But now these, the original ways that we had of being with them seem to hang on, and they come right back up when there's a trigger.
Yeah.
That's what a trigger does. It hurls you back into the wounded place when you weren't ready to go there.
Yeah.
That's why they're so painful. Because you're being forced to look at something that you weren't ready to look at.
Yeah.
Remember I said the most important thing in trauma work is timing. Like, can I look at this now, or do I need to get stronger before I look at it?
Yeah.
And for most of us, we still have to get a lot stronger before we can look directly at all the things that happened to us.
Yeah.
And that we're still holding on to as resentments.
Yeah. Thanks, Dave.
Okay, I guess our time is, we're moving in the direction of setting up our breakout rooms. And of course, the topic is very obvious. It's what kind of triggers come up in my family? What are the ones that, or let's say the one that bothers me the most or that hurts the most? And especially if you can pay attention to how you trigger others. So either how you're triggered or how you trigger others. And Tim will let us know when to come back.
Yes, I was just typing those questions into the chat. So there's the question right there for conversation. We're going to spend about 20 minutes in some breakout rooms. You will be randomly assigned by Zoom to a group of 3 to 4 people to discuss this question that Dave has just offered up. And then last week we did a 5-minute break from 11:20 to 11:25. So we'll still do that. And then we'll have about 20 minutes coming back to continue this discussion. So, but my reminder for all of you is, as you go into groups of 3 to 4, accept the invitation to the dialogue, and when you do leave between 11:20 and 11:25, if you get up to go have a bio break or just stretch, do anything your body needs to do, remember not to log out of Zoom or to close your laptop or anything like that. Just keep it open so that when you come back in, you'll automatically come back into this main Zoom room that we're in right now. So you're going to be assigned here in just a moment, and again, we'll have this discussion on this question Dave offered from 11 to 11:20. From 11:20 to 11:25, you will have a little bit of a break, and then we'll come back and start right at 11:25 back in with Dave. Okay?